What do you do when you've had a great deliverance? I had a couple of weeks holiday and I was driving home on Friday, or Carolyn was driving, in fact, I was texting. So I'm texting away, looking down, and we're down a country road, about to join the A30-something in Cornwall, and we're down a pretty narrow road with just sort of one carriageway either side. And we're approaching a left-hand bend. I'm kind of messaging my family and mucking around and pretty relaxed. And I look up, and we're approaching this left-hand bend to us. And I look up, and there is a car coming towards us on the other side of the road. That's cool. There is also a car coming towards us on our side of the road, a little white car coming very fast towards us. And in a surreal moment, we are then facing this car. And I look up and quite casually think to myself, we are going to die. It's a very strange feeling that your brain works so quick and you just look up and you think, we're going to die because it's coming straight towards us and there's nowhere for us to go. And then in some moment of miraculous, I don't know, from either the normal means or some extraordinary means, three cars fit down this two carriageway road. And everything seems to kind of expand. And Caroline gives a little shriek, and she's pretty controlled, and she verges a bit to the left, but there's kind of a grass bank, so there's not like miles to go on the left. And I don't know what's happening on the right, and I don't know what's happening with the white car, but somehow we squeeze through, and it's all over in just a few seconds. And it's only afterwards you think, wow, we really could have died then. We're going 40-50, they're going 40-50. There's no way we probably would have survived. Certainly not without injury and probably not without death. And then you just get on with your lives and I go back to messaging, I suppose. But no, actually, as you start to process it, you think, wow, that was really serious. And God did preserve us. And you thank him for it, don't you? It was a deliverance. Now, I'm not trying to make a drama of that story just to help with my sermon, because it really did feel like we were going to die, honestly. And I'm very thankful to God for the fact that we didn't, and thankful for Caroline's sterling work in just keeping the car straight and not kind of going crazy with it. And I'm sure the other drivers too all breathed in at the same time. What do you do when you've had deliverance from great danger, a really tragic, difficult situation? What do you do? Do you breathe a sigh of relief? Do you say, wow, that was lucky, wasn't it? Or do you give praise to God? And how do you give praise to God? What forms are you going to give praise to God in? Are you going to just give a quick prayer? Or are you going to live a life of praise? Are you going to be ecstatic, exalted, enthusiastic in your praise? When you're saved from certain judgment and death, like the Israelites were, when the scale of salvation is beyond all expectation, not just deliverance from an accident in a car that can happen, but something that's so extraordinary and so obviously the intervention of God, so much beyond expectation, then it's time for a song, isn't it? This here in Exodus 15 is probably the first song recorded in the Bible. Unless you sort of count the little bit of poetry that Adam says, bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh in Genesis or something like that, which probably wasn't a song, but something sort of added by Moses as he writes about creation. So this is pretty much the first song in the Bible. And the context is a great deliverance. See that in chapter 14, verse 31. And when the Israelites saw the mighty hand of the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and in Moses, his servant. They'd been delivered. Remember the plagues? 10 plagues ending with the plague of the firstborn. They'd been delivered through the plague, right through to that death of the firstborn, which happened right across Egypt. But it didn't happen to them. They were delivered. Their firstborn were delivered. And then, perhaps more immediately, they were delivered as Pharaoh and his army decide, no, we don't really want to let them go. We've got no one to serve us anymore. So we're going to pursue the Israelites as they leave us. And he gets all his chariots together, all his best chariots, 60 charioteers, I think, and people riding them and loads of other of his army. And they're pursuing them. And as you saw last week, I think God gave an amazing deliverance. He blows. He causes some natural phenomenon to happen where the sea is parted, the Red Sea, and the Israelites are able to walk through on dry land, walls of water either side. And then it happens again that God intervenes, and then the water flows back over as the Egyptians pursue. They think, oh, we're going to catch up with them now, but no, they don't. Because God changes the wind, changes the circumstances, and the army is drowned. Is it the army are drowned? That's the context in which this song is written, praising God for his judgment on the Egyptians as they've been hurled, as it says, into the sea. This song is full of what the Lord has done. There's a repetition of the Lord 14 times here. There's a great emphasis on what God has done, not what they have achieved, not the lucky escape they went through, not that, oh, what interesting circumstances. That was really unusual, wasn't it? No, it's really all about the Lord and what the Lord has done. It's a really significant song, I think, because it's echoed in Revelation chapter 15. You don't need to turn to it, but just to be aware that it's there in Revelation 15 at the end of our world history and in the ushering in of the New Age. There's also a declaration of the victory of God. So in Revelation 15, it says, "Great and marvelous are your deeds, Lord Almighty. Just and true are your ways, King of the nations. Who will not fear you and bring glory to your name? For you alone are holy. All nations will come and worship before you, for your righteous acts have been revealed." And this song sung in Revelation is described as the song of God's servant Moses and of the Lamb. So this is a kind of foundational song, a song of salvation, a song that informs, will be sung right through the Old Testament and right through into the New Testament. And at the end of time, that song of salvation is still being sung. Not exactly the same words that are being used here in Exodus 15, but that idea that we sing to God, the God of salvation, the mighty victor, that carries on right through the Bible. And it will be our theme song in the new heavens and the new earth, won't it? Song of salvation. Let's have a look at it together. Oh, there's all my headings all in one go. That's the way it seems to map out. It's one of those things where sometimes when you've got a Bible passage, you kind of need to work through the logic and that kind of thing. What you need to do in a text like this, I think, is just try and let it breathe. That's what we're going to try and do this morning. Just let it breathe together. It's not kind of a text to be studied in quite the same way that other texts are. You're just supposed to feel it. So the first couple of verses, the Lord, the exalted King, Moses and the Israelites sang this song to the Lord. Don't know quite in what context they sung it and how it was composed and quite when and so forth, but this is a summary of what they did in response to the salvation and the fact that they're now putting their trust in God. And the song begins by declaring God is exalted. "I will sing to the Lord," verse 1, "for he is highly exalted." Exalted means lifted up high, put on a pedestal, put up really high, and rightly so. "Both horse and driver he has hurled into the sea." Some of you who have older translations might have horse and rider, but I think most people think that there weren't riders of horses so much with the Egyptian army, but they were drivers of chariots. So the idea is the horse and the rider of the chariot have been hurled into the sea. That was the big kind of technology that the Egyptians had, was charioteers who could pursue the Israelites. So it's their kind of symbol of their strength that's being thrown in the sea, the horse and the rider of the chariot, the driver. And they could see clear evidence of the fact that God is exalted because he's hurled them into the sea. And so they're going to say, "I want to sing. I will sing." And that "I will sing" is a very emphatic "I will." It's not "I shall sing." It's definitely not "I might sing." But it's a real commitment to the idea of singing, saying, I will sing, I'm going to sing, because it's so great what God has done. And so I'm going to lift his name high. Then it talks about the Lord, the victorious king, verses 3 through to 6. The Lord is a warrior. The Lord is mighty in battle. The Lord is his name. He's a covenant God. What happened? Well, Pharaoh's chariots and his army, he's hurled into the sea. Just in case you didn't remember, that's what happened. He hurled them into the sea. The best of Pharaoh's officers, those drivers of chariots, they're drowned in the Red Sea. Do you remember that? The deep waters have covered them. They sank to the depths like a stone. What happened? Your right hand, Lord, was majestic in power. Your right hand, Lord, shattered the enemy. It's the Lord who's the victorious king. It's not freak weather. It's not our ingenuity. They've been cast into the sea because the Lord has done it. And so we want to praise him. We want to exalt him. It's your right hand, O Lord. It's the symbol of your power. It's you stretching out your hand and doing something. And it's shattered the enemy because you're a mighty warrior, God. There in verse 5, and again in verse 8 actually, there's the idea of the deep waters. Some people make a connection with the deep at the beginning of the Bible in Genesis, where it says the Spirit of the Lord hovered over the deep, hovered over the ocean. Maybe there's some echoing of that. It's also the same phrase used when there was the flood, Noah's flood, when the waters of the deep kind of swelled up as well as the rain coming. Certainly, I think there's the idea of the sort of uncontrollable chaos of large bodies of water being subdued and controlled and brought under the power of God and used as an instrument in God's hands. The deep waters have covered them. Not chaos, but order and purpose. The Lord's a victorious king. And then verses 7 to 12, the Lord is an incomparable king. Verse 7, in the greatness of your majesty, you threw down those who opposed you. You unleashed your burning anger. It consumed them like stubble. By the blast of your nostrils, the waters piled up. The surging waters stood up like a wall. The deep waters congealed in the heart of the sea. Again, it's attributing to God a kind of human faculty of having nostrils and so forth, like having a right arm. But it's the idea that this wind emanates from God. Of course, there's what you might call natural causes. There's stuff happening. There's things that are causing the winds to blow in the way that they're blowing. But ultimately, it comes from God. And he's incomparable. You see, he's compared with the enemy. See that verse 9, the enemy boasted, I will pursue, I will overtake them. I will divide the spoils, I will gorge myself on them. I will draw my sword and my hand will completely destroy them. And in the way the poetry is written, you can't quite get it. You can sort of get it if I read it fast, but you can't quite get it in the English. Because the way it's been written, it's like this. There's a breathlessness about what's being written down here. The Egyptians are kind of excited. They just can't wait to catch up with the Israelites, and they're rushing after them. And they're saying, I'll pursue, I'll overtake, I'll divide the spoils, I'll gorge myself, I'll draw my sword, and my hand will destroy them. So there's their breathlessness, and then there's the breath of God. Calm, controlled. Decisive. The breath of God breathes out. And what happens? The sea covers them. They're judged. There's all their breathlessness and there's all their excitement. And then it says they sank like lead in the mighty waters. Can you kind of feel it? The kind of idea of this excited army rushing forward and roaring perhaps and thinking they're going to catch up with the Israelites and then just the sound of sinking people, almost a silent set of deaths going on as they fall to the bottom. You know, it's such a great story that it's really hard to capture. I know there's been a few films that have tried to do that. And not the cartoon Prince of Egypt, but some other ones too. And it's such a thing that it's almost better just to have a few words to describe it and just kind of imagine it, because it's such a thing, isn't it? And so verse 11, who among the gods? Of course, they don't think there are gods, but it's just kind of using that expression almost in a derisory way. Who among the gods is like you, Lord? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glory, working wonders? You stretch out your right hand and the earth swallows your enemies. This is the Lord, who's the incomparable King, the powerful, calm, judgmental breath of God blows and the sea covers his enemies. So who could possibly be compared with this kind of God? Who is like you? It's a really great idea to be reminded of. Who is like you, God? Who's like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glory, working wonders? Who's like you in his majestic power as king and as warrior, as we thought about already? Who's like you in his holiness, his purity, his consistency, his absolute moral perfection? Who is like you in his awesome glory? Who is more glorious, more to provoke awe, to deserve awe than you? And who can work wonders like you? There's the Lord, the incomparable King. Fourthly, there's the Lord, the King, who leads his people home. Verse 13, in your unfailing love, you will lead the people you've redeemed. In your strength, you will guide them to your holy dwelling. The song moves from what has happened through to more what's going to be happening and the ultimate goal of that. The people are going to be led to your holy dwelling, the end of verse 13. It's going to be a witness to the nations. See that verse 14. The nations will hear and tremble. Anguish will grip the people of Philistia. The chiefs of Edom will be terrified. The leaders of Moab will be seized with trembling. The people of Canaan will melt away. Terror and dread will fall on them. By the power of your arm, they will be still as a stone until your people pass by, Lord, until the people you brought pass by. So that's what's going to happen. The people are going to be brought home. There's going to be a witness to the nations as that happens. But the ultimate goal of them passing by is that they get somewhere. And you see that verse 17, similar at the end of verse 13. You will bring them in, plant them on the mountain of your inheritance, the mountain where Moses met God, the mountain where they will meet God. You will bring them in to the mountain of your inheritance, the place you made for your dwelling, the sanctuary, Lord, your hands established. They will go to that mountain. They will meet with God. They will have the presence of God then traveling with them. They will go and they will land themselves in the promised land. They will live in the promised land, and God will live there with them and be their God. That's the destination for them. And so the last bit, really, the Lord reigns forever. Let's sing about it some more. See that verse 18? The Lord reigns forever and ever. Just in case you hadn't got the idea already through the song, here's a kind of summary. Here's the main bit. The Lord reigns forever and ever. And then again, a bit of context for you, just in case you haven't got it. Verse 19 and 20. Well, this is what happened. Pharaoh's horses, chariots, and horsemen went into the sea. The Lord brought the waters over them. And then it says, there's another response, where Miriam, the prophet, Aaron's sister, took a tambourine in her hand, and all the women followed her with tambourines and dancing. Miriam sang to them, "Sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. Both horse and driver he has hurled into the sea." And if you're like super attentive, you'll realize that that is a repeat of the beginning of the song. So the assumption is that's either a bit of a chorus or that's the beginning of the song. It's going to be run through again, perhaps many times. So something that Moses and the people sing is something that then Miriam joins in with and gets all other people to learn it and to join in too. I don't want to show you all my headings, so you'll have to just wait for them in a minute. It would depress me too much. So what can we learn from this? One thing that's just a general observation, not so much something that we can learn, is that everybody sings. Everybody sings. Yeah, if you make them progressive, Joel, I'll give you some Cornish fudge later. Everybody sings. Singing is part of being human. It's part of the good that God created. It's not a consequence of the fall. Singing is not a consequence of the fall. It's good. It can be distorted, of course, like all the good things there are in the world. It can be idolized, but adding tone and rhythm doesn't change the meaning, but it adds depth. And songs have a particular way of expressing personal and shared emotion. I had a birthday recently, and my mum, unbeknown to her really, bought me a set of Bluetooth headphones, a new set of Bluetooth headphones. And so I was mowing the lawn yesterday with my new Bluetooth headphones on, and I don't know if you realise, but when you're mowing the lawn, you have to turn the volume up really loud so you can hear what's being sung. So I've got some fantastic sound going on in my head, and I can't hear the lawnmower, which is a petrol one, so it's quite noisy. And so I'm mowing my lawn yesterday, and I'm listening to the soundtrack of A Star Is Born, the most recent A Star Is Born. It's a fantastic set of songs in there. There's almost not a duff song on there. I know some of you won't like it, and the language on the film itself is a bit appalling, but actually the film's great, and the soundtrack is brilliant. And do you know what? That might have been because Caroline's staying with her sister, and I'm on my own, but such emotion. You know, you're mowing the lawn, and you know, grass cuttings flying everywhere and stuff, and you're listening to a song about sort of lost love, and about how Lady Gaga is the character in here, is she wants to die looking at the guy that she loves, and particularly when it's kind of living in your head through the headphones. You know, I wanted to cry. No one would have noticed because I'm just mowing the lawns. They might have just thought I was getting a bit emotional about mowing the lawns, you know. I haven't seen my lawns for a couple of weeks and I'm so pleased to see them again. But I wanted to cry. That's what music does for you. I don't think I'm unusual in this, am I? Music has a power of moving you, which is beyond the words. It's connected with the words. Because it was the words that were kind of moving you, but it's the connection of the words and the music that kind of drive you to this emotional position. Now, of course, that can be distorted and misused. But if it's directed right, it's a great thing, isn't it? Singing is part of all cultures, over all time. Singing is something we can do individually, we can do collectively. Think about national anthems, think about football songs, think about songs that promote good behavior, think about songs that will educate or improve memory or give us a sense of identity and fun. Think about how song words rest in your mind. I was listening to something relatively modern, I suppose you might say, yesterday. But what's remarkable to me is that I was once in a car with a guy, this is a bit of an aside, but I was once in a car with a guy from Italy. So he's an Italian speaker, grew up in Italy. And in English, he could recite all the words of all the Beatles songs. So we were in a car journey once with him, and so I just went through all the Beatles songs I could think of one by one, and he could recite all the lyrics of all the songs in English. And in Italian too, just if we asked him. But actually, that's not that unusual. It's pretty unusual to do it in another language. But, you know, I could pretty much recite nearly all the Beatles songs. I used to love Bob Dylan. I still love Bob Dylan, but he can't sing anymore. But I used to love Bob Dylan's songs, and still do. And I could pretty much recite all the words of all the Bob Dylan songs and all the words of all the Bruce Springsteen songs. But you begin a song by Oasis, like, you know, step outside the eye of your mind, and you might find, and you're all thinking, yeah, that's Don't Look Back in Anger. Some of you are thinking that, maybe of a particular age, I don't know. But that song kind of is embedded. I could recite all the words of that. If you want to be my lover, then you've got to be my friend. You know, that's in there as well. You know, there was a pop quiz thing, and there was just the beginning of Wannabe by the Spice Girls, and there was a little section where there's a ha at the beginning, and Caroline said, that's Wannabe. I was like, how do you even know that? How do, like, 10, 15 years, I don't know when it came out, how do you even know, just from the little bit of intro, you got like the whole lyrics of the song in your head. Songs and song words have an ability to just embed themselves in you. Now, as a slight other aside, there's a danger in that because it means you need to be careful what you're listening to. As part of my general education, I've been trying to work through listening to lots of different radio stations, not just the sort of talky ones that I'm on a bit more, but to listen to, kind of in order, Radio 5, Radio 4, Radio 1, and Radio 2. That's my sort of, that's my basic method. So I've just lost connection for something, so I'm slightly distracted for a second, because I need something. wonder what you're all thinking about while this is happening. Thinking about why is he bothering or something like that. Where is it? There we go. We're back. And part of that, kind of looking at some of the radio stations, I just need to remind myself, because I'm not so culturally aware that I know everybody. Roughly speaking, Radio 2 has songs about love and sex. And roughly speaking, Radio 1 has songs about sex and a little bit about love, roughly speaking. And just knowing the power of words and how words embed themselves in me. I was listening to a Rio Grande song, which is I'm Not Your Girlfriend, You're Not My Boyfriend. And so I thought, that's deep. So I thought I'd look at the lyrics for that. And there's something about kind of, I suppose, the confusion of, are we in a relationship or are we not in a relationship? I'm not your boyfriend, you're not my girlfriend, but I kind of love you. But then actually in Googling it, I managed to get the wrong song, which is, it's called something like Leave Your Girlfriend, I'm Bored, Leave Your Girlfriend. I think some idea like that. Is that Leave Your Girlfriend, I'm Bored? Break up with your girlfriend, I'm bored. So I looked at that and I thought, that's not the song I'm listening to about I'm not your girlfriend. This is saying I want to be your girlfriend. And just knowing the power of words to embed themselves in us, it's just worth kind of reflecting on. I know I used to bore my children to tears when they were younger about listening to stuff which was kind of similar. And I was saying to them, what exactly are they saying there? Are they saying I want to sleep with you? Are they saying I want a lifelong covenantal relationship with you in marriage? I don't think so. I think they're saying I've just picked you up at a nightclub and can we go and have sex as soon as possible? And when we have it, it's going to be great and we're going to pump and grind and it's going to be good. And then I'm going to see lots of other girls all over the place and I can sleep with them too and you can too and it's fine. But now I've got a bit of anguish because you left me and you've been unfaithful to me and that's a shame too. But I'll get over it and I'll find someone else to sleep with. That's kind of the basic kind of idea. Now, if you want to teach your kids to sing about that, and if you want to sing about that, that's cool in a way, but it's not, is it? It's a kind of a sentiment and an idea, and most of us do it and learn it kind of unconsciously. But just knowing the power of good words to implant good ideas, then it's worth just thinking about it. And I'm not saying you should never listen to Radio 1 or Radio 2 or any of those other stations and never listen to songs that talk about things, but just listen with your brain plugged in as well as your earphones plugged in and kind of think, what am I hearing? Just have a little bit of reflection. Don't be like me, like paranoid, but just be a little bit reflective about it and think about the bulk, the majority of what you're learning and think about the power of words to teach. We'll think about that in a moment. So the first point is really, everybody sings and everybody learns songs. Most of you have grown up in the sort of pop culture, even the elders among you are old enough to have lived through the 60s and so on, and you all know loads of songs like I just was speaking about earlier. Everybody sings. Second point, God's people sing. Singing with instruments occurs right throughout the Bible. There's the song here, of course. But from the beginning and through to the end, people are singing. Singing becomes part of the worship of God in Israel, doesn't it? David has 4,000 musicians, a really big band. The Psalms are mostly poetry that is meant to be set to music. Words of praise, encouraging affections, encouraging a will that's in line with God's word and God's will. Songs that are repetitive, songs that are full of content, but songs that are full of emotion and expected to provoke emotion. And in the New Testament, as I said already, we're still singing. God's people always have sung, and we need to sing in response to what God has done for us. In as much as we will be affected and we will want to, we will not want to, but we will learn songs of artists that we like, then we really want to learn and sing songs that express praise to God and truth about God. God's people have always sung. God's people are still singing. Are you? Thomas Aquinas says, he who chants, sings, prays twice. It's the idea of the mind and the body kind of integrating. It's the idea that you got the content, but it's more than the content. When we sing, there's both that memory capturing, but it's also the idea of throwing our emotions into singing. God's people sing. God's people are supposed to sing. And then God's people are to sing together and with great enthusiasm. Here it seems that Moses is maybe the prime mover in this song, maybe composing this song or whatever. But it seems like the people join in, and then Miriam and with a tambourine joins in. So everybody joins in this song. God's people sing. It wasn't an optional thing. It wasn't in this case that, you know, like, Moses, sing it to us, Moses. No, it was like, no, we want to sing it too, because we got saved too. We're joining in this one. You ain't going to sing it to us. We're going to sing it with you. God's people sing together and with enthusiasm. Miriam the prophet, Aaron's sister, took a tambourine in her hand, and all the women followed her with tambourines and dancing. Now, what do you reckon? Passive, dull, boring, enthusiastic, exuberant. I think we're supposed to think exuberant, enthusiastic. Tambourines, walking around. It seems like they were rather excited. Didn't it seem like that to you? Now, I'm not arguing for the resurgence of tambourine use particularly. But enthusiasm, exuberance, a little bit of dancing, I don't know. Show me you mean it. Singing together and with enthusiasm is what God's people are to do. Singing is part of church life. See in Ephesians 5, it's a well-known passage talking about singing to each other, making music in our hearts. It's the people in Christ with the Spirit of God in them. That Spirit-filled life is expected to result in giving up the self-indulgent life, getting drunk, taking drugs, singing songs about that, going away from that, turning off the radio, and actually deriving deep joy in the presence of God and in enjoying the Spirit of God living in us. And one of the signs of that is the desire to sing. Because the Word of God dwells in us richly, because we've learned a lot to sing about, then we will sing with great enthusiasm. We will sing regularly, and we will sing joyfully. So are you? Everybody sings. You can't get away from it. God's people are to sing. Are you singing? God's people are to sing together and with enthusiasm. When we gather together like this morning, how are you singing? What's your kind of approach to singing? Is this kind of an optional extra as part of the meeting? Is it something you think, well, that's for these people and not for those people? It's not for me. It's not my kind of thing. I'm not a singer kind of person. I'll just go with the kind of preaching stuff, but the singing, I could sort of take it or leave it. That doesn't seem to be biblical. It seems to be more biblical to say singing is a key part of praising God. So when the first note starts and you're asked to stand up, are you thinking, this is a key part of praising God? This is part of my worshipful life. This is part of me saying to myself, to God, to the people around me, I really do love God. And I'm really grateful for the salvation he's brought me in Christ. I'm singing a song of salvation. I was lost and I've been found. I was dead and I've been made alive. I was a sinner. I was racked with guilt and pain that followed from that. And I've been set free from that. And I'm completely forgiven. And I'm blessed in so many ways. So I'm going to sing about it. Because as we sing to God and we sing to each other. We sing to praise God for who he is and what he's done and to worship and bless him. And we sing as part of trying to build one another up, as we teach each other truth, as we actually, in a way, give emotion to each other. I'll confess something to you, which is sometimes I start singing a song here and I've got no intellectual connection with the words. Do you have that sometimes? You know, you stand up and you start singing, and you sing, you know, so come people of the risen King, delight to bring him praise. And you're kind of there, and you know the words quite well, so you're there. But you just know that your mind is not there. But you can sing, because you've done it quite a lot in your life, and so you keep going, and you keep singing. And sometimes it's a really rubbish time, and you get to the end of the song, and you haven't. So let's confess that too. You still haven't connected. But often, just the experience of singing eventually draws you in. And you get to to a bit that particularly kind of appeals about, you know, those who are weeping through the night in that particular song, people of the risen King. And for those who are going through darkness, and you still keep singing, you still keep praising God. And somehow that kind of sparks something. And you really start to connect with the song. And then you're singing the rejoice like you really mean it. So the whole experience has actually helped you. And you could say, well, that's just emotional manipulation. No, it's not. It's just God working through the means of grace with genuine, true content that you genuinely do believe, but just stirring you up in your soul to really be encouraged by it. Do you agree with this? Everyone looks a little bit stern. I don't know. I think it's what the Bible would teach us. I think it's what our experience teaches us too. That God's people sing together and with enthusiasm. And we need to do that. But here's a really important thing. The songs are primarily about what God has done and what God is doing for us and in us. Now, you can get too carried away with this and say, oh, I don't like songs with I in it and all that kind of thing. And then I can point you to Psalms that talk about the I as well. So you can become paranoid about it. But as a big kind of story about our singing, it has to be the story of what God has done and is doing. We should sing truths about God, about his work of salvation. Of course, about our experience of it, because that's what they're doing here. Moses and Miriam are singing about, well, what's happened to us? We've been saved by this means, and it's really great for us. So there is a personal element to it and a personal connection to it, but it's mostly about what has the Lord done? What has the Lord been doing? What will the Lord do in us? Where is the Lord taking us? Where are we going? We're on a journey. We're on a journey to the new heavens and the new earth for us. For them, it was on a journey to the promised land. And for us, it's thinking, okay, what has God done? The big content of our songs has to be the salvation that God has brought about through Christ. So we sing a lot about the life and the death of Christ and the resurrection of Christ and the significance of that, how it has brought about salvation for us. And it's right to sing a lot about that. And we sing about the future. We sing songs about the higher throne to which we will one day come. And we sing songs about where we're heading. And we sing songs about our relationship now with God, that we are walking with him. So of course it's about our experience of that, but the emphasis always has to be about God. What is God doing? It's God who's brought this salvation in Jesus. It's God who's walking with us every day right now. It's God who's bringing us through some trials and some troubles as we witness to the nations, right through to glory and to the new heavens and the new earth. And we sing about all those things. And we give praise to God for that. And I think it's worth saying that singing is one thing, and I've talked quite a lot about singing this morning, but this song has to be part of a life of worship. There's the song and there's the singing, and there's what we learn and what we teach. But there's also, this should not just be an emotional moment. So we say, yeah, I get what you're saying, and I'm really going to sing with enthusiasm when I come and gather together with God's people in future. That's not enough. That's not really grasping the bigness of this. This is about the song that defines our life. The song that says, I want to live a life of praise. Sometimes it will be singing together, and that'll be great. And sometimes it will just be trusting God through the really hard times. But it'll always be about praising God and being full of joy. So as we close, a couple of questions. Have you yourself got a song to sing? Perhaps you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, and you kind of get the emotional ideas, but you can't really see that it's something worth singing about. You like singing, but you're not sure that this is the thing to sing about. And I just want to say to you this morning that this is ultimately the only thing that has to be sung about. And if you haven't got this song to sing, you haven't really got a song to sing at all. If you this morning can't say, "The Lord has become my salvation in Jesus," if you can't say this morning that my sin, the judgment I deserve, the enemies of death and Satan have been thrown into the sea as Jesus dies and rises, if you can't say that, then you have no song to sing. Have you got a song to sing? Have you put your trust in Jesus? Have you been saved? Because you can be. You can be part of this great group of people. You can join in with Moses. You can join in with the saints in the book of Revelation. You can join in with us Christians who are here this morning singing songs about salvation. You just have to put your trust in Jesus and embrace him and say, "Please forgive me my sin. Please be the Lord of my life. I want to follow you through to glory, and I want to follow you singing as we go." Have you got a song to sing? And if you're a Christian, have you got a song to sing? What do you sing about? I tried to challenge a little bit in terms of perhaps what you might learn from listening to the radio and other songs and so forth. Are you both learning and singing lots of Christian stuff? Not to feel a bit self-righteous and pompous, but just because that's who you are. And that's who you want to be. You want to be someone who's full of praise. Make up your own songs. Read a psalm and just make some music to it. Do anything. Learn what you possibly can. Whatever works for you. Whatever style of music. If you like old hymns and you need to keep learning old hymns and listening to old hymns, listen to loads of them and learn them and learn the words and so forth and sing them to yourself. If you like modern songs, get lots of modern songs going and listening to them through the week as well as on a Sunday. And learn the words. Practice. When the words are on the screen, just close, no, don't close your eyes because you might fall over or something, but just don't look for a minute. Think, am I learning? Are these becoming embedded? Am I actually engaging the brain? You know, could I recite all the verses of five of my favorite songs? I'm sure I told you this before, but I was in Hungary on a camp once and was just amazed, not really amazed, but it was just kind of challenging that there was a guy playing the guitar and they all knew the songs. No words, they all knew the songs. You know, and they said, "Oh, let's play this song in English." You know, it was some really well-known chorus in English or something. And they started playing the songs. And all the English people are like, "Da, da, da, da." Because, you know, we knew about the first three lines. And then we didn't know anything else after that. Because we're not engaging enough. We're not really kind of learning, getting into it. So have you got a song to sing? And parents, I kind of alluded to it already because I had about 300 asides. But do teach good songs to your kids. It's really good if you know all the words to the Power Rangers theme tune, which I should learn. And there are many other songs and themes of various things. It's really good if you know all the words to Frozen. All the songs in Frozen. You know, that's fine. It's good to learn and, you know, practice your musical ability and everything else. And it's good that your kids know that. But do they know stuff about Jesus? Do they know lots of songs about Jesus? You're really not going to get enough songs in them just coming to a few meetings at church. You've got to listen to stuff at home. You've got to teach them stuff at home. It's a bit creaky, but you've got to sing stuff at home with them sometimes. Why? Because you want them to learn about Jesus. You want them to have it running through their brains. You don't want to indoctrinate them, but if they're not learning that, they're going to be learning something else. You want them to learn about Jesus because you want them to love Jesus and you want them to sing about Jesus. And you want, when they're like 50 years old like me, to still remember stuff they learned when they were 5 and 10 about Jesus, because it'll help them. So teach your kids to sing. Not just, "I love it when you call me Señorita." It's very catchy. I think I heard it once and I've got it. They play that on Radio 2 and Radio 1, incidentally. It's a kind of crossover song. It's number one at the moment. "I love it when you call me Señorita." It's about a bloke who picks up a girl in a bar somewhere, if you look at the video. And, you know, they sleep together. Cool. Great song for your kids to learn. Great themes for them to get in their heads. Now, you might think, "Oh, it sounds a bit cheesy if, you know, I learn about, you know, Jesus and stuff like that. And, you know, they need to be knowing some of the songs that their friends are knowing and everything else." be aware, talk about what the song's about, but spend time teaching them songs about Jesus. And if you need any help with any ideas, I can give you some, other people can give you others. I've probably gone a little bit overboard this morning, but it's an important topic that we don't cover that often. It's the Song of Moses. I've spoken a lot about kind of our own singing and our own learning, but to bring it all back, it's about the song that God teaches us. It's about what God has done and what God is doing for us and in us. Have you got a song to sing? Non-Christian, start singing a song because you place yourself in the hands of Christ. Christian, sing with great enthusiasm together with God's people and teach those songs to your friends, to your family, and especially to your children for the glory of God. Amen.